Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. You're 12 years old. Your mother is dead and your father has gone missing. You're wrenched from everyone that you know and love and put on a train and sent from your home to a new country where you don't speak the language with a group of complete strangers. And you have no idea whether you will ever set eyes on your family again. This was the terrifying reality facing Gabrielle Weiss when she boarded a Kinder transport train out of Nazi-occupied Vienna in April 1939 and was sent to live in England in the months building up to World War II. On the 85th anniversary of the Kinder transport scheme, the 97-year-old shared her extraordinary story with me.
My name is Gabriele Kienigen now, but I was Gabriele Weiss. I was born on the 10th of November, 1926.
1926, wow. So that makes you 97 today, am I right in thinking that?
This year I'll be, yes, in November I'll be 97. My father, mother and I lived in the second district of Vienna, which was the Jewish district. My father was Jewish, my mother was Christian, and thereby hangs my tail, of course, because I became a target for the Nazis because of that.
Indeed you did. So what do you remember about when Germany, well, they didn't invade, but when they entered into Vienna, they were welcomed, weren't they? There was a lot of flag waving.
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
I remember it vividly because by this time, my mother sadly had died. My mother died when I was only 8 years old, five.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, became my guardian.
Yes. Now tell me about your grandmother, because she sounds like a wonderful woman.
She was. She was absolutely fantastic. She was my mother's mother. But she was also a very busy lady. And my father, his business had to be kept up. So he stayed in Leopoldstadt, the second district of Vienna, which is the Jewish district.
Yes.
My grandmother lived in the ninth district because my grandfather, who was no longer alive, I never met him. He died long before I was born. He was a doctor, and the ninth district was where a lot of hospitals were, and so a great many doctors and professional people lived in the ninth district.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really lived in the ninth district with my grandmother.
Yeah,
but because she was such a busy lady, she sent me to a boarding school, but I was only a weekly boarder.
Oh, so you came home at weekends?
Came home at weekends. And each weekend, my father used to come and visit.
Ah.
And we all got together, you know. So it was lovely. I mean, sad, because I missed my mother greatly.
Oh, you must have done. That's a very formative, it's a very difficult, well, there's no great age to lose a mother, but at 8 years old.
Yes.
What a blow.
It was a blow. I remember, what I mainly remember is Kristallnacht. I remember the Nazis marching into Vienna. Some of us were on the windows looking out, and they marched through the city, all the main streets they marched through, and people were welcoming them. And I didn't really know what was going on, you know. Mm. I didn't understand it all.
No, you wouldn't as a child.
I didn't know at this stage what the implications would be. Soon after they actually annexed Austria in March 1938. And in November 1938, which was obviously a few months later, we had Kristallnacht. Now, I don't know if you've re researched this stuff.
I have heard it was the night there was some retribution, wasn't there? A
Yeah,
so-called retribution.
it was in revenge on the Jewish population, because a Jewish youth had gone to the embassy in Paris, and he was so cross about what the Germans were doing to his parents that he assassinated one of the ambassadors. And in revenge, the Nazis had decided they would take their revenge in each city where they were in power. So it included, by this time, of course, it included Poland, Czechoslovakia,
yeah.
Austria, Germany. And so in all the main cities of these countries, they had this retribution of Kristallnacht,
yeah.
where they went around, they pulled people out of their homes. They, I think they shot a few people. There was shooting going on. There was screaming. There was crashing of glass. I mean, I remember it so vividly, as if it happened yesterday.
Do you really? Where were you then, Gabriel, when this happened?
That night I was in the convent, because it was the night before my 12th birthday. And we had plans for my 12th birthday. My father and my grandmother were going to take me out and celebrate. And it was must have been during the week, because I was in the convent. And I remember the nuns being terrified. They had shutters on the windows. They closed the shutters to try and keep the noise out. But it was such a horrendous night that you couldn't keep the noise out. Everybody was scared stiff, you know.
Yeah, I get chills listening to you talk about that, you know, as a child, and feeling that fear that you must have felt.
We were absolutely terrified, hearing the screaming of people and the shooting and the crashing of glass. It was a horrible experience. And I suppose because it was my birthday the next day, I remember it so vividly,
yeah.
You know, because I had looked forward to my 12th birthday and had made plans for it. So, of course, the next day...
There was no celebration to be had the next day.
No, but my grandmother came to collect me because it was my birthday. She came to the convent, but my father had disappeared. And that... We had no idea what happened to my father. My grandmother went to his office, and it was in disarray. She went to where he lived. Nobody knew what had happened to him. Nobody could tell her anything about him. He just disappeared.
And as a child, how did you even begin to process that as a young girl? Because one minute you're supposed to be going out celebrating your birthday with him and having sakkotaa and, you know, a lovely day out, the next thing you know, there's this night of explosive violence, and then he is gone. What went through your mind?
We couldn't understand it. My grandmother did search quite, you know, she did try to find him, but there was no sign. And nobody seemed to know where he was. It's only years and years later that I found out what happened. I think that night, well, I don't know what happened that night to him. Years later, I did find out what happened. He was eventually deported from Vienna, but not till 1940. So it was over a year later. So I think he must have been in hiding, because I can't understand why nobody knew anything about him. Somebody must have hiding must be hiding him. But eventually the Nazis did catch up with him, evidently, because I can't remember the month, but I have got a letter from the Vienna, which said that he was deported to Litzmannstadt in Poland.
Okay.
Litzmannstadt is actually a city called Lodz. but the Germans called it Litzmannstadt. And it wasn't a concentration camp, but it was a Jewish ghetto.
Okay, so his fate was sealed, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, so he was deported to this Jewish ghetto. And after that, there's no trace.
Gabriel, how did you, as a child, because you had already lost, you had lost your mother, and then 4 years later, your father disappears overnight without trace. Your whole world is turned upside down.
But I don't know. But my grandmother was so great that
okay.
she just seemed to be my rock, you know. And
oh, what a wonderful woman.
She
what,
was.
What are your memories of her? What did she look like?
Is there not a picture in my book?
I well, think yeah, she was a beautiful woman, wasn't she?
Yes. Where my mother was as well. I mean, they were, you know, they were in a great family. Mm. And my grandmother kept me safe. And then when my father had disappeared, she began to have fear for me.
Mm. You know,
she thought something was going to happen to me, and it would have done, because she told me she survived the war, as you might have read. And she told me that it was only months after I came to England and the kinder transport, somebody came to her door and inquired about my whereabouts. So
it must have,
yes. Well, I'm not sure whether it was months or whether maybe it was when they actually deported my father. That they tried to trace
that they
me.
Start to try and find, but you had long gone. So let's talk about the kinder transport, if we may. I mean, I my basic knowledge of it is that 10,000 children were taken out of danger from Europe and sent through this scheme to England. You left in April 1939, I believe. Tell me about your memories of the time leading up to that. Did it happen very quickly? What did your grandmother tell you?
Well, she didn't tell me anything. I didn't
oh,
know
really?
anything about it. And you know, funnily enough, Kate, I never asked her afterwards. I should have asked. I don't know how she found out about the kinder transport. B, I don't know how she arranged it. But when I met her again after the war, it never occurred to me to ask her all these questions.
Well, you and everybody, we all have wishes that we'd ask more, or these sort of questions that we wish we'd asked.
Yes, I wish I had asked her, because she would have told me.
Of
because
course.
She did tell me that somebody once came to her door
right.
and asked about the whereabouts of Gabriele Weiss. And she said her heart just turned over.
Oh.
But she was so pleased to be able to say she's no longer in this country. She's in England.
What an incredible sacrifice for a woman to make for her granddaughter, to get her out of arm's reach of the Nazis and get her to safety. I mean, what a sacrifice she made for your future, never knowing if she might see you again.
No, we didn't know.
I feel so emotional considering the impact of that. Can you imagine you as a grandmother being in that position?
No, I couldn't. My grandchildren are grown up now. I've got a great grandson.
Oh, congratulations.
I've got another great grandchild on the way.
Oh, wonderful.
So,
and really, we have your grandmother to thank for that, don't we? The continuation of your family.
Of my family, yes.
So tell me about the day you left Vienna on the train. What's your memories of that? And you wrote in your book, and it really struck me, that people weren't outwardly emotional. There was no crying or sobbing, because people were worried that, because obviously the Nazis were there on the train platform.
And they had been told there had to be no emotional scenes.
Oh.
So the adults had to try and keep their emotions in check. And my grandmother did very well. And I always wondered why, as the train drew out of Vienna slowly, why she was smiling and waving to me, but she was trying to give me courage, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't that, I mean, she must have felt like crying.
She must have felt like breaking down, but she held it together for you.
Held it for me, yes.
And what courage, Gabrielle, for you to, as a young 12-year-old girl, to get on board a train. Did you know where it was going? Did you know you were going to England?
Yes, yes. I knew my grandmother had had a letter to say that my name had come up on the list. And because a few kinder transport trains had left Vienna before that, you know. And she got the letter saying which day I was to be at the station. And we had to leave at midnight, which was such a strange time for children. And I've got my own thoughts about that, because I think that, you see, as you said, and as I said, the Nazis were welcomed in Vienna. But that was in March 1938. Now, by April 1939, I think a lot of people regretted having welcomed them.
Right.
And I think in order not to alienate the public any longer, anymore, I think they made our departures at midnight, thinking there would be not many people around.
Out of the public gaze.
Yes. They wouldn't get to know that the Nazis were sending children unaccompanied to strange places, to a foreign country.
Isn't that interesting? I never realised that you were sent at midnight, which, under cover of darkness, of course, to conceal their activities, because they knew that probably the wider population of Vienna would recoil at that. The way of children. So there you are, a 12-year-old girl at midnight on a train, pulling out. What's your last memory of saying goodbye to your grandmother?
I wrote a little ditty about it. The departure. Children were named and numbered because we had to have a label around our neck. And when I went to schools, I had made myself a label of cardboard and I had it around the neck of my teddy bear.
Oh.
Because we were allowed only clothing in the case and one soft toy. That's all we were allowed to take with us. So children were named and numbered. Their faces showed great fears. The station platform was crowded and people shed bitter tears. I'm sure they did inwardly. The suitcase was heavy. The journey ahead would be long. We were just little children and not very strong. A suitcase and soft toy was all we could take. Came the midnight departure and the last loving embrace.
Oh.
Anyway.
Gabrielle, I have to be honest, I'm struggling not to cry here listening to you reading that, because I think of my own son, is 12 years old. I cannot imagine what it would be like for a 12-year-old on their own, the fear, the expectation of what lay ahead.
I know. I mean, it's indescribable, really. But I think we were partially numb.
I can understand that.
The fear, the anxiety, the sort of anticipation of what was going to happen to us. There were 150 children that night on that train.
Yeah.
And we were all on the platform initially, and the Nazis sort of, well, you'll be able to read my article about the kinder transport.
Yeah. But they boarded the train regularly, didn't they, at various stops,
well,
I understand.
At various stops, yes. The train stopped on many stations, and the people got off, the soldiers got off, and others got on. So they must have been stationed in different places, you see. And when new ones got on, they would come through the compartments. And sometimes they even opened children's cases to search them, yes.
But they didn't search yours, did they, Gabrielle? Is that
no,
right?
No, they didn't. And that was when I found I found at the end that it was very lucky because I think my grandmother had the foresight to put writing paper
Yeah.
envelope and a pen in at the bottom. I think if they had found that, they would have
They
confiscated
probably would have done, wouldn't they? So that was very fortuitous that, well, A,
it.
that your grandmother had the foresight to do that, and B, that you were never one of the children searched that day. What were the other children on the train like? Do you remember? Did you strike up conversation or did you talk to one another?
I don't think we did very much. I think we were all too
Shell-shocked.
sad and worried. But we had some younger children there, you see. There were children of 4 and 5 year old.
Wow, so
But
young.
they had to have older brothers and sisters on
Yeah.
the train as well. To describe what I felt is almost impossible.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Because I still, it's so vivid in my memory, leaving Vienna. And people say, how can you go back to Vienna with all those memories? But I have so many happy memories of
Yeah,
mother.
yeah. Well, it was your childhood home, wasn't it? It's where you're from. It's important to return. But you, of course, you could never have known that that night in April 1939 that you would ever return. You, as far as you were concerned, you were going on this very long journey. What did you think of England before that? Did you have any idea or notion? What was your idea of or perception of what England was like?
I had started, I was in my first year in the high school, and we started to learn English. And the only English I knew was sort of good morning, good evening, and
Yeah.
I was actually only in the class from September till April because I had to leave then, and that was the first year in the high school, you see. So I had no idea what England was like. In fact, I don't know why, but I never even, well, I suppose as a child, you don't think of researching it, do you?
No, of course you wouldn't. You'd take things as they're presented to you.
So the journey seemed endless.
Of course.
And then suddenly all the soldiers got off and the train stopped. And we looked out and somebody came and opened the doors and asked us to get out and onto the platform. And they told us that we were in Holland. We had gone over the border into Holland. So all the Germans had to get off
Of
and
course, because it was unoccupied territory at that point, wasn't it?
And they had prepared a feast. There were
Oh.
festive tables all along the station platform, and they had things to eat, things, drinks. They even had prepared some small toys for the smaller children,
Wow.
and they but the smaller children at this time were quite cantankerous, of
Of
course.
course.
Because the journey altogether must have taken, I don't know, we went from midnight, but the next day, I can't remember what time we arrived.
I can't imagine how many fractious, exhausted children there must have been.
Actually know that we left. I actually know that I came to that I entered England on the 26th of April because the Home Office once I had to get proof of when I entered, when I became a British subject. And they sent me the date, 26th. But I think we left at midnight on the 24th, I
Yeah.
think.
So a 2-day journey, but I was really struck, Gabrielle, when you said that you when you got to the Hook of Holland, what was your feeling when you first saw the sea?
Horrified, horrified. I was, well, all of us were frightened when we saw the sea because we were told by somebody who could Dutch people, but the Dutch people speak very good German. So we were able to communicate with them. We were told that we were going on a ship. We were going to go on a ship and go across to the other side. Now, the other side was not visible because there was just water and water and water. And Austria, being a landlocked country, I'd stood on one side of the river Danube and seen the other side.
So in your mind, you were expecting that, were you?
Yes, and I had been to the lake, the Salzburg Lake District with my grandmother and seen various lakes, but you could always see the other side or the other end. And here we were, and all we could see was water.
Oh.
It was quite frightening.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to see this huge expanse of water with seemingly no end in sight.
No end in sight. And then the ship actually came and we had to board the ship. And I had my teddy bear. He has hardly any fur.
Oh, look at that. Gabrielle, that's a piece of history you're holding in your hand. I cannot believe you still have your teddy. How old is he now then? He's 85.
Probably, I don't know how old I was when I got him, but he must be, I would say he's 90 years old. I must have been 6 or 7.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
I got him when I came back from Berlin to Vienna and started school. So, yes, he's about 90 years old.
You and he have travelled together, haven't you? You've had some life story and life journey together. It's extraordinary that you still got him.
And he used to growl when you moved, but the mechanism inside him no longer works, you know. He's almost bare. He's hardly got any fur on, but he's much treasured.
But he must have been an enormous comfort to you as a 12-year-old girl boarding that boat, holding your teddy bear. He was your comfort, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. We were allowed one soft toy, and that was my soft toy.
Oh,
he's not that soft. He's quite
threadbare now, but that's okay. He's lived a long life, and he served a good purpose to you, didn't he?
Yes.
He was your comfort blanket.
He was.
Yeah. Oh, I just, it's so incredible that you still have him. He's an heirloom now, isn't he?
Well,
it's a treasure.
He doesn't belong to me anymore.
Oh.
To my daughter.
You've passed him down.
Yes, I passed him down, but she lent him back to me so I could take him to talks.
Oh, how incredible.
Yes.
I was not expecting you to pull him out. I didn't realize you still had him after all these years.
Yeah.
Oh, Gabrielle, that's wonderful. So you're on the boat. How long was the journey on the boat? Do you remember?
Yes, I think we came from the Hook of Holland to Harwich.
Harwich, that's right, yeah.
We landed in Harwich. I think it was about 8 or 9 hours. It's one of the longest crossings.
Mm. It's not like I'm going from Dover to Calais.
No, it's a long one. It's much longer. I think maybe 6 to 8 hours. Yeah. I don't know. But we were very lucky because it was April and sometimes the channel can be quite rough.
Yes, yes.
But we had a very, very smooth crossing.
Oh.
And I can't remember anybody being seasick. You know, so that was,
thank goodness for that. And then from there, you were taken to Liverpool Street Station, I believe.
Yes.
Where, of course, today is that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a wonderful sculpture, isn't it, of the children holding their suitcases. I've seen it many times.
I love the base, which has all the little plaques on with the names of the cities we came from. I've got pictures of it.
Yeah, for anyone listening who hasn't been to Liverpool Street Station and seen that sculpture, I would urge you to go and visit it because it's a very poignant reminder of how little you were when you arrived. You're just children. I always find it staggering, the thought of you all arriving, in the build up to war in this foreign country where you couldn't speak English and you knew nobody. What an enormous the enormity of that journey. So who met you at Liverpool Street Station?
Well, because I was brought up as a Christian, I came under the auspices of the Catholic Committee for Refugees. They were based in Kensington. They had an office there, and there was a lady called Miss Baggett. She was the lady who met us. Lovely lady, and I kept in touch with her for years and years and
Oh,
years.
did you?
Yes. When we met, we couldn't communicate. She couldn't speak German, I couldn't speak English, so it was all sort of by expression and
Yeah. But you could
yeah,
tell by her body language and her smile that she was
her
kind.
was kind, yes. But my journey wasn't finished because evidently I was going to, which I know now, but I didn't know then. I was going to a couple, I didn't know who I was going to, but I was told that a couple had offered to give me a home, but they lived in Aldershot. So the lady who met me at Harwich took me. We all went up to London to Liverpool Street Station, and she then had to take me across London because I had to get another train to Aldershot.
I
And
presume
it,
you might have gone from Waterloo Station to
yeah.
Aldershot, I'm guessing. So you had to go via the tube system to Waterloo. Do you remember much about London?
No, I don't. I think I must have been in a dream because I couldn't speak to anybody. Everything was strange. All the voices I heard were, I couldn't understand anything. And I think I must have been just bewildered because I've got very little recollection of my journey across London to Waterloo Street, to Waterloo Station. But I sort of remember that. The train that came in Waterloo Station, there were compartments. The compartments were different to what they are today. They were sort of lengthways. There was one door and you went in, you didn't, yes, they didn't sort of, they were all separate
I
compartments.
can picture it, and they had the slam doors, didn't they?
Yes,
That
yes.
opened in half, and then you step straight into your compartment.
Compartment, yes. And I remember the door opening and some people sitting in there already. And I think, well, she did tell me later that she told the people where I was going and a little bit just about me. And she asked them to see that I safely got off at Aldershot. But she gave me a piece of paper with Aldershot written on. And I had no idea what it was all about. And I kept looking out every time the train stopped. Eventually it stopped at Aldershot. And the people in the compartment sort of made signs to me that I had to get off. And I had to take my case and my teddy bear and get off. And I stood on the platform, and the platform was completely different to any other station platform I had seen so far because it was practically empty.
And that was the end of your journey there, really, wasn't it? Because you
Yeah.
disembarked at Aldershot, which I presume was has always been a kind of army territory, Aldershot, hasn't it? They have army bases there.
It's a garrison town. Well, my first of the couple came towards me and sort of smiled at me and held their hand out. So I gathered they were the people who were going to give me a home. My foster father was in the regular army. He was a regular army officer. And his wife was actually Hungarian. She
Oh,
wasn't
really?
English, but she didn't speak German. And of course, Hungarian is quite different to German. So we still couldn't communicate. But we, again, sign language and expressions were used. And I went with them, and they took me to their home, and the lady took me upstairs to a small bedroom and sort of made signs to put my case on the bed. She put it on the bed, opened the case, and sort of showed me where to hang things. And it was when we emptied the case right at the bottom that I found,
Your grandmother's
yes,
writing paper.
writing paper and envelopes and a pen.
What an extraordinary woman your grandmother was to do that for you.
And you know, I also then had a faint memory of one of the last things my grandmother said to me, write as soon as you get there. And I hadn't really taken much notice of that. But you know, I then realized what she was on about. So I did. I wrote to her. But that writing didn't last very long because that was April, and in September the war
Of
broke out.
course, of course.
And from the 3rd of September onwards, there was no communication with
That was
Austria.
it. I suppose it would have all been shut down from that moment forth, wouldn't it? And so, how many letters did you manage to write to your grandmother before the
Well, I wrote every
onset of
week.
hostilities?
Yeah, I wrote every week from April till the end of
To set,
August.
yeah. And what, how were you treated in those first, before the outbreak of war?
Well, before the outbreak of war, I was treated very well in the home of the couple. But as soon as war was declared, my foster father was whipped away. He had to take, I don't know, some. He was sent to some secret place.
So yes, your foster father was whisked away, as you said, to a secret place, and you were, of course, then at that point just left alone with your new foster mother.
And her attitude changed
Oh,
completely.
really, really? In what way?
Well, she started using me like a maid. I had to do all the housework when I came in from school, and I was a very studious sort of girl. I wanted to learn English very quickly, so I brought books home, and I wanted to immerse myself in them, you know. And she treated me quite badly.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Why do you think her attitude changed?
I
Because she
think
was frightened?
she saw me as the enemy.
Oh, really? Which begs the question, why she took you in the first place?
Well, I think it was only because war was declared. I don't know what kind of person she really was, because I never really got to know her very well. But somebody went to the school that I was in. I was in a little Catholic school, primary school in Aldershot, and I think somebody told the head teacher
Really?
that they thought I was being not treated very well. And she, in turn, because she was in touch with the Catholic Committee for Refugees, because they had arranged for me to go to that school, you see.
I
And
see, right.
and then the lady who met me at Harwich came to Aldershot, but she came to the school to interview me. And she couldn't believe how well I could speak English in those few months.
Really, you picked it up very quickly, didn't you?
Yes, I did, very quickly. But the children, I think the children in the school helped me a great deal. They were very kind, and if I
Really?
did, yeah, if I didn't know a word, they would tell me the word, or they would hold something up and say that's called paper or that's called cup, you know. And I don't know, but and they always kept speaking to me, and I just in 3 or 4 months I seemed to be able to communicate.
Wow, what a wonderful, children have brains like sponges, don't they? They just
Yeah.
absorb information very quickly. So that was must have been a huge relief that at least you were able to communicate with other and play with other children and start
Yeah.
the semblance of a normal life, I suppose.
Well, it was, but I was very unhappy once my foster father had left, and she said to me, "Well, don't worry, Miss Packard." She said, "We'll find you another home." But it wasn't found till after Christmas that year. But she came back down to Aldershot. This time she came to see my foster mother and said that they thought that I should go to another convent school. And I was sent to a convent school in Ashford, the Sisters of Notre Dame. They had a boarding school in Ashford.
Oh, do you know, you're going to laugh at this, that my son now goes to that school.
Really?
Yeah, he goes to a school in Ashford that used to be a convent school. It's now a boys' school. It's a beautiful building, isn't it?
It is.
Oh, that just sent the hairs on the back of my neck off. I did not know you went there.
Yes. Well,
Oh, wow.
that's where I was taken. And I worked very hard,
Yeah.
and I was very happy there. The nuns were absolutely lovely.
Oh, good. Good.
And during the holidays, school holidays, when the boarders all went home, they used to take me with them to their sort of holiday home and treat me very well and take me out, and it was lovely.
So happier times.
I had really happy times
Yeah.
because I couldn't communicate with my grandmother because
Yeah, that line of communication was cut off.
cut off. So I worked as hard as I could because I always felt I wanted to be a teacher.
Really?
From being quite a young child, I think when I was in the boarding school in Vienna, I was so impressed with the nuns there and the teachers. I thought when I grow up, I'd like to be a teacher. And I still had that thought when I was at Ashford, but that's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's and it's it, if it's the same, it must be the same place because it's a beautiful building, isn't it?
It
Very,
was
very old building,
very
surrounded
old.
by beautiful grounds, and there's a lake.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, I guess that's incredible that that's where you were. I know it so well. I can picture it. And to the thought of you having a happy, this being the turning point in your life so far, I suppose, that
Yes, it was.
it signaled the start of a happy time for you, fills me with happiness that you started to get on your way in life at that point.
Well, I did. And I was there. I sat school leaving certificate, which you sat at 16. We only had to do 5 subjects, not like they have today.
Many more now. So I'm assuming with all this going on, you becoming happier, you've learned English, you're sitting your exams. At this point, it was the period known as the Phoney War, I'm guessing. There wasn't, this was in the build up to September 1940 and the Blitz, because by the time of the Blitz, I understand you, where were you then at that
In
point?
London. Well, what happened was, when I, at my, just after my 16th birthday, I had a visitor, and it was Miss Baggett, and I had already sat my exams, and she knew the results, and she said, "I've got some bad news for you." Well, I felt bad news. The only bad news that I could think of was about my grandmother, but then I knew that there was no communication with her, so I couldn't understand it. I said, "Bad news, what's the bad news?" Well, as you reached your 16th birthday, you've become an enemy alien. And afterwards, because it was on the coast, it was a restricted area. Aliens weren't allowed to live there. So I had to leave the convent. And I was devastated. I was devastated because I had hoped to stay on and matriculate, you see.
Yeah, of course.
And I couldn't. So they, and she understood that I wanted to be a teacher, but she said, I'm not sure that we can afford to fund you for all that time, because it would mean another 2 years for matriculation and then 2 years teacher training, which was 4 years, and they couldn't fund that. But they could fund me for a further 2 years. So what they did, and they were very good to me, they found a convent in Mill Hill in London, which was a nursery training college. And they said, well, you'll be able to work with children and you'll get a profession, you'll become a nursery nurse. But they also ran a Montessori course side by side with the teacher, with the training for nursery nurse. So there was a sort of slight touch of some sort of teaching there. And they said that was the best they could do for me. And I was there for 2 years. I went to Mill Hill. I had to report to the police every month because I was an alien.
Yeah. And obviously what they meant by that was the fact that you spoke German. There was a huge amount of fear and suspicion, wasn't there, at that point?
Yes.
Because well, it was the build up to the potential invasion.
Well, she actually, Miss Baggett explained to me that I was known as an enemy alien because the Austrians had welcomed the Germans into their country.
Despite the fact that you were fleeing persecution.
Yeah. The fact that my country welcomed them, I was an enemy alien. People who fought against the Germans taking over their country, they were friendly aliens. But I wasn't a friendly alien. That's why I had to leave this country. I think if I had been a friendly alien, I might have been able to stay. I'm not sure, though.
It seems staggering, though, doesn't it, that you were a child who was forced to flee your homeland. You know, there is a least likely threat. I cannot imagine why you were put in that category.
I don't understand. No. I didn't understand. I don't think she understood it.
No, I'm sure.
But I had to follow instructions.
But nevertheless, you ended up in North London working for...
I ended up in Mill Hill at St. Vincent's Nursery Training College. And I did 2 years there. I was happy there. We worked hard and I sat my examinations and I learned a great deal. And the nuns were very good because at the end of my 2 years there, they actually found me a post.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I went to a family in Surrey who had three children. They were a very nice family. There was a baby and two toddlers, and I was going to look after them. They were quite affluent. So, in fact, Woldingham, I think nearly every household in Woldingham had a nanny. People seemed, you know, moneyed people there. And again, I was happy in my post. I loved the children. And I liked looking after children. And when we went out in the afternoon for walks, I met up with other nannies and made friends.
Uh-huh.
It was quite a pleasant time.
Yeah. Just going back a little bit, Gabriel, can you talk me through your memories of the Blitz in London when you were training?
Yes. Well, we spent many times in London. When I was in London, we spent many, many nights in Erith shelters.
Yeah. Did you have an Anderson shelter, or what sort of shelter did you stay in?
I don't know what can it was in the ground somewhere.
So an Anderson sort of sunk into the ground.
Sunk into the ground, yes. And we spent many nights there. And one night, I remember vividly, we came up from the area shelter that had been a siren. And when we came up, the sky over London seemed to be reddish. And we said, "What's happened? Why is the sky that color?" But that night, evidently, the Germans had bombed and they'd dropped incendiary bombs, and half of London was burning.
Gosh, and you witnessed that. Do you remember what it smelt like or the air?
The air was heavy,
Yeah.
yeah, but we didn't actually, there was no bombing near the convent,
Yeah.
so we didn't see any destruction, but evidently there had been a lot of
Yeah.
destruction in London that night. And it was the reflection of the fires that shone in the sky.
What a thing to witness. Do you remember feeling fear or fascination or both?
I don't think I was frightened then. I think I felt hatred of the Germans.
Yeah. Did it feel somehow as if you were being followed because you had fled your homeland and here
Well,
they were, now they'd arrived on, well, they were attempting to bomb England into submission, weren't they? Obviously, it failed,
yes.
but it must have felt like. I can understand that hatred at that point.
I think I was frightened that they might invade England and that I would be again a target, you
Yeah.
know.
Yeah.
I was hoping against hope that England would, you know,
Prevail.
be victorious,
Yeah.
prevail.
But at that point, you make a very good point there, Gabrielle, because at that point, I think in the build up to, after the evacuation of Dunkirk and in the build up to the Battle of Britain and the Blitz, I think there wasn't a case of if, but when. I think there was this, people were so convinced, weren't they, that this,
Yes.
that sort of febrile atmosphere that of course the Germans could well do it. It felt like a very real possibility. So I'm not surprised that you felt that fear that it, oh God, here we go again.
And that's what I couldn't understand. By this time, of course, you know, I was an adult.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
18 years old. And then, of course, I also experienced part of the Blitz, the doodlebugs coming over, but
Yeah.
that was when I was in Woldingham, not when I was in
Okay.
London.
Yes, because they started a week after D-Day, didn't they, the
That's
doodlebugs?
right. I remember then, and I remember when you heard the noise, and then there was silence, and you knew that there was a doodlebug which was about to drop. But we had Biggin Hill, and they had loads and loads of barrage balloons. And the barrage balloons brought the doodlebugs down. And every time they brought the doodlebug down, you heard it and you clapped like mad.
What a thing to witness.
And you know, I think today, I was thinking of, I was hearing that the drones were coming over Ukraine. And they were shooting down so many drones. And I thought, well, it must be like the barrage balloons that brought
Yeah,
down
the
doodlebugs.
doodle bugs. Yeah,
It's just a more sophisticated way of
it's a more sophisticated weaponry, but it's the same
yeah.
concept, isn't it?
Same concept, yes.
Yeah, yeah. You're
I,
so right.
when
80
I
years
heard
on.
that they had, I think they brought down more than 20 drones last night. And I thought, good for the Ukrainians. And I think Putin is just another Hitler,
Yeah, he's a dictator.
a dictator, yeah.
Of course. It's just, it's a different war, but it's the same concept behind it, isn't it? It's a totalitarian regime trying to, yeah, you're so right to make that comparison.
So anyway, then I was with this family in Woldingham on VE Day,
Oh,
the
tell me about
German
D-Day.
and they gave me the day off to celebrate, because all the other nannies were given a day off, and a few of us banded together and went up to London, and we stood outside Buckingham Palace.
Did you?
On D-Day. Well, you've never, never known such an atmosphere. It was tremendous.
Oh.
I've never forgotten that. Everybody was singing and dancing and clapping, and people were climbing up trees to outside Buckingham Palace. There were thousands of people there. And of course, the King and Queen came out on the balcony, and Princess Margaret and Princess Elizabeth. And Princess Elizabeth, I always, she was born the same year as me. I always allied myself with her. I was very sad when the Queen died.
Oh, you must have been.
Yes, I had a few tears.
Of course, of course. What a moment, though, to be a part of history and to see them coming out on the balcony and to, you know, and hear the roar of the crowds. What
yes.
did that feel like? How did you feel inside?
Oh, absolutely. It's indescribable, really. So elated and so, I don't know. I just felt euphoric, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was lovely. And then eventually, of course, we had to go back to the train. And it wasn't until I was on the train back to Woldingham that I thought, the war is over. I can get in touch with my grandmother.
Your grandmother. I was
because
just thinking that, yeah.
When outside Buckingham Palace, that thought didn't strike me.
Did it not?
You know, there was so much going on and so much.
You were caught up in the height of the moment, I suppose.
Yes. But as soon as I was in a sort of silent place, I thought about my grandmother. So when the next day I wrote a letter, sent it off. Well, it came back to me about 6 weeks later, not known at this address. And I thought, well, how could she not be known at that address? But maybe something's happened to her. So I felt really quite sad, you know. And I said to the people I was with, I said, I think my grandmother's no longer with us. I said, you know. However, a week or two after that, I received a letter from Vienna. Well, I knew the handwriting. It was my grandmother's handwriting.
Oh.
And she had the foresight to get in touch with the Catholic Committee for Refugees. Well, of course, they knew. They kept track of me all the time. They knew exactly where I was. They gave her my address. And so
oh.
And
she survived.
She had survived. But you know what had happened? We owned the apartment that we lived in the 9th district, but they commandeered it for one of the officers, Nazi officers, and they put my grandmother in the smallest apartment you could think of in the outskirts of Vienna, in the suburbs somewhere, and she was very unhappy. But she got no recompense for that.
Really, even after the war, she wasn't able to get the apartment back. Really, where's the justice in that? But can you describe your feelings when this letter turned up from Vienna and you recognized your grandmother's handwriting?
I couldn't speak. I couldn't think. I couldn't wait to open it. You know,
yeah,
it was absolutely fantastic. And by this time also, it was the children that I'd been looking after had been there for 4 years. They're starting school and nursery and whatnot. And I think it was time for me to move on. But the gentleman of the house I worked for the Home Office. And he said to me, now, before you leave us, I'm going to make arrangements for you. Do you want to stay in this country or do you want to go back home to Austria? And I said, no, I want to stay here. Because I had sort of made my home here somehow. I couldn't think of going back to Austria to my grandmother in that little pokey. You know, I just, I didn't, as much as I wanted to see her, I didn't, well, that time you couldn't travel anyway. I didn't want to go back. So he made arrangements. He arranged for me to become a naturalized British subject. And he said, it's got to be done before your 21st birthday, because after your 21st birthday, it's quite costly to become a British subject. Must have to pay for it. I don't know whether that's still, you know, so don't forget that's going back to 1945, 46.
Sure,
you know.
Sure, different times.
And different times. Anyway, he drew up all the documents, and I had to go before before a magistrate and swear allegiance to the king. And I had to renounce my Austrian citizenship.
Now, how did you feel about that?
Well, I felt a little bit anxious about it, but I thought, as a British citizen in this country, I'm safe, and I can go. The time will come when I can travel and all of that. But the lady, his wife, was a, she was the Honourable Mrs. Richardson, so I don't know what her background was. I never really found out. I couldn't really ask, you know, she was my employer. But she knew that I wanted to be a teacher, really, not a nursery nurse. And she had contacts, many contacts all over the place. And she knew somebody who was in teacher training, involved in teacher training in the Northeast. And she said to me, would you like me to make inquiries about teacher training? I said, well, would I be accepted? She said, well, I don't see why not, because she said, you did do, you were educated to 18, although you haven't matriculated. But she said, I could make inquiries. And it was just after the war when they were quite short of teachers. She got me into a teacher training college.
Wow. So this family were really very supportive towards you, weren't they?
They supported.
Enabled you to become a British citizen. They that set you up on a path of training. I mean, it was quite transformative.
Yes.
For you.
And I came, I was sent for, I got an appointment in Newcastle for an interview. And I had to come up and sit some examinations. I had to do an English exam, maths exam, and general knowledge exam, you know. And I had two or three interviews with different people. And then I wasn't given, at the end of that day, I wasn't given any sort of result. But they said they would let me know in good time. And I went back to London, waiting with, you know,
nervous excitement.
Nail biting.
Yeah.
And then I finally got a letter to say I'd been successful and I had a place at Wynyard Hall Training College. Wynyard Hall is now a hotel, beautiful. But after the war, it was used as a training college.
Right, right.
But because they were very short of teachers and they opened other places as training colleges. And so I came up to the Northeast and I've been here ever since.
That's extraordinary. How many years, Gabrielle, did you work as a teacher, all told?
Altogether, well, I was out for 5 years. When my children were small. But I taught 2 or 3 years before that. Altogether, I think I taught 36 years.
Oh, how incredible. What a contribution you made.
And the last 10 years of my teaching career, I was a head teacher of a middle school.
Do you find it hard when you look back and you think of that 12-year-old girl who couldn't speak a word of English, boarding a train and a boat and a train and, on this incredible journey that you would end up, I think in 2019, you were included in the Queen's Birthday Honours List, a long career in teaching. Did that seem conceivable to you as a child?
No, not as a child. But I did have aspirations of becoming a teacher. So I
Yeah.
must have, I must have been a little bit wanting to get on in
Yeah.
life. Yes,
Yeah.
and of course, in the meantime, I met my husband as well.
Yes, tell me about that. He was in the RAF, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. He was a flight sergeant in the RAF, and on one of my weekends in Newcastle with my friend from college, because she used to take me to her parents, because we could go home at weekends, and so she used to take me home with her, and her mother welcomed me with open arms because she had a daughter who was in the WAF and was a
okay.
Home. So, and she said, she always told me I was similar to her daughter. So, I actually stayed with them until I got married. When I came out of college, I stayed with that family. They were, again, very kind to me. I've met so many kind people in my life.
I'm so heartened to hear that for all the horror, that it was tempered by so much kindness.
It was. I mean, I'm eternally grateful to many people, anyway, on this particular weekend, the friend that I came home with, her sister came as well. She had the weekend leave. And so we shared a room. And she said, I'm going to the Nafi Club. There's a tea dance on this afternoon. Do you want to come? And we said, oh, yes, yes, we'd like to come. So the Nafi Club was the club for forces, And it was in Newcastle. It was a big one in Newcastle. So we all went to the tea dance in the Nafi Club. And guess what? I met my future husband.
Tell me about his name was Ken Keenahan. What first impressed you about Ken when you set eyes on him?
I don't know, nothing very much. He said to the commissioner, he was standing talking to the commissioner when we went in, and he said to the commissioner, are you letting these ladies in? And the commissioner said, yes, I am, because they're with this lady who's a WAF. And he went on talking, and I never gave it another thought. We went up to the place where the tea dance was taking place, and about a quarter of an hour later, he must have come upstairs, and he came and asked me for a dance. And yes, he was quite handsome, and he seemed nice and friendly and kind, and told me about himself and was interested to hear some of my story. And when we parted, he said to me, can I see you again? And I said, well, I'm at college. I'm only here for the weekend. He said, well, can you give me your address? And I'll give you mine. So we exchanged addresses, but he was still in the RAF and he was going back to Bedford. He was stationed in Bedford. He was just home on leave then. So we started corresponding. And then, I don't know, just went on from there.
The rest is history. What extraordinary people you both were, because you had come, well, your story, as we've heard, is so unique, but I'm guessing that in the RAF, had he been active during the Second World War? I mean, obviously you met him post-war, but had he served in the war?
Oh, yes, he'd been.
Wow. So what had been his role? Obviously he was in the RAF, but what did he...
Well, he was a flag sergeant, but he was also involved with the communications, and he was stationed during the war, at some stage during the war, he was stationed in Kenya, and he actually was responsible for building for radio aids to navigation, because he was into that sort of
thing.
And he was given a group of convicts to help him build this. And he couldn't speak Swahili, and they couldn't speak English. So I think he had quite a hair-raising experiences.
Well, you had both had such hair-raising experiences. When you came together, both young people, you know, did you want, at that stage, did you just want to look forward, or did you look back much? Did you talk about the war, or was this sense of, no, now we need to look on, you know, this was the welfare state was beginning, wasn't it? And everybody was determined to focus on the future. How did you personally feel?
Well, he got the mob shortly later, after that. And of course, I finished my training. And when he got the mob, he got a job in Newcastle as a radio engineer, just with a firm, you know. And when I finished college, he had a surprise for me. Because by this time we had, you know, known each other nearly 2 years, well, over a year anyway. And he asked me to get engaged. So we got engaged, engagement ring. And he had arranged, he bought a car with his demob money. And he had arranged a journey to Vienna.
To see your grandmother?
Yeah. And I didn't know anything about it.
No.
It was all arranged. And we had a hair-raising journey because he took the car, he drove to Vienna via Switzerland. And then when we got to the Austrian border, we had to adhere to certain, I don't know, he'd been told which route he had to take. He couldn't just go because Austria was occupied by the French, the Americans, the British, and the Russians, four occupying forces in Austria. And we had to avoid the Russian until we came just outside Vienna. We couldn't avoid the Russian section there. We had to pass the Russian section to get into Vienna. It was quite exciting, you know. It was exciting and emotional. And because I was so emotional and so excited, I think some of the memories have sort of gone, you know.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Because you left Vienna as a 12-year-old girl, and now you're returning. What age were you now, Gabrielle, when you returned?
So I was about 24.
Okay.
I was in my early 20s.
Yeah. So you're a young 24-year-old woman with a, you know, engaged, you're a teacher. What a different circumstance that you returned to Vienna, that you left it.
I don't think I was as old as that.
Yeah. So you returned on the arm of your handsome fiancé. You're a very different person to the one, that terrified girl that left. Tell me about the reunion with your grandmother.
I was just speechless. But you know something? I never forgot my journey. Now, a lot of people who came over at the same time as I did had forgotten German altogether. I speak still fluently.
Do you? How interesting.
And my daughter, this is something I'd like to tell you. My daughter has just obtained Austrian citizenship through me.
Oh, really?
And so have my two of my grandchildren.
That's quite special.
They were able to, I had to renounce it, but they were able to claim it through me because
even though you had renounced it.
Because I was, yes.
That's really special. I mean, that must mean a lot to all of you that they've been able to do that, to reclaim some of your heritage.
Yes. Well, they've now got that. They've got dual nationality. They've got British passports and Austrian passports.
Oh, wow. That's very special. That's very special. You must be very proud of them. So what happened when you walked into, where did you meet your grandmother when you came back to Vienna? What had been arranged?
Well, she... She had given me her address, and we founded my fiance or my husband, as it became. It was absolutely fantastic finding places and doing things. And we found a house and we met her at her house, yes. But, well, it wasn't a house, it was an apartment house. And she had this tiny little apartment. So we stayed at that stage, we stayed in a hotel. And then later on, we went every year to Vienna. But after we were married, we bought a caravan and he took the caravan to Vienna, had it on the camping site. And so she met not only my husband, but she also met her great grandchildren.
Oh, how wonderful.
We went every year, we went to visit her.
She must have been overjoyed to see you not just alive but thriving.
Yes, she was.
It must have vindicated the choice, that terrible choice that she made.
But she had a rather sad life, I think, in a way, because she became a widow, and I've been a widow for many years now. She became a widow when her children were quite young. They were teenagers. My mother had a sister, and they were, I think, 2 years apart. And they were just, one was 16, one was 18 when my grandfather died. So my grandmother became a widow then. And she actually outlived both her daughters.
Oh, that's sad. That's very sad.
Because my mother died when I was eight.
Yeah.
And then my aunt died when I was, well, she was in her 60s when she died. I was teaching then, married and everything. And she lived in Zurich. And we had the job to go to see my grandmother, tell her that my auntie had died. And she said she was in her 80s then, but by this time she was in an old people's home. She couldn't cope by herself in this.
What a lot of tragedy she lived through, though, and experiences that she had. It seems inconceivable, doesn't it? The choices that she must have faced, but she must have been very pleased, I assume, that she made that choice to get you that ticket on board the Kinder transport that saved your life. That must have been the one thing that she felt out of all that darkness that she was able to do for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And so tell me, you know, when you reflect back on your experiences, so many rich experiences, how does it make you feel that you survived all that, and that not just survived it, but you came to this country and you learned English and you thrived and went to teacher training and had this long career as a teacher and all the experiences that you embraced. How do you feel when you reflect back on that?
With surprise and wonder. and with tremendous gratitude to all the people I've met along the way who helped me to achieve what I did achieve. I didn't achieve it on my own. I had help.
Oh, true.
You see. And so I've got so many people to be grateful for. Of course, my grandmother, immensely. She was the one that really, you know, started me off. But I've come across so many nice people and people who were helpful, and I just can't explain it.
Yeah.
I just a great gratitude, and I feel a great gratitude to this country for having accepted us. And then even recognized me to give me the British Empire Medal. You know, I just.
But I think this country owes you a great deal of gratitude. I think it's the other way. I think that you came to this country with nothing, and yet you embraced every opportunity that you were given and contributed so fulsomely to this country. I think that we owe you a debt.
I don't feel that. I feel that that was all, I don't know, maybe good luck. Good luck.
I think I had a bit more than good luck on your part. Because you've displayed such resilience and resourcefulness and, you know, hope. You never let go of hope. How do you think that being a child of the Kinder Transport shaped the rest of your life?
I'm not sure that that it had, because I think I put it behind me and looked forward all the time. I don't think I looked back, except for the relationship with my grandmother. That was the only thing I wanted to look back on. And everything else, sort of, I don't know.
Yeah.
And the funny part about it is, I joined an organization just recently, well, not recently, a few years ago, just by chance. I heard about the Association of Jewish Refugees. If you look at the book, that's books been written to them. And because my heritage is, I'm a Mischling, half Christian, half Jewish. And through them, I've met many people who've had similar situations to me. And I sort of feel that, well, they've survived as well and they've flourished. And I think all we can do is say thank you to Britain for giving us that safety, you know, and that...
Looking back now, you know, this year is 85 years since Kinder Transport began. What do you think people, or what do you hope people will learn from your story and the story of Kinder Transport?
Well, I don't know, because the world is in such a mess, Kate.
Well, true.
I honestly don't think that human beings have learned anything by it. I think individually people have, but as a combination of nations, we haven't really learned much. I mean, they said never again, never let this happen again. When I give my talks about the Holocaust, there have been so many genocides since then. There was Rwanda, Bosnia, you know, the genocides in so many countries, and the whole world seems to be cross and angry and hateful, and we haven't learned anything. I would love to be able to have a magic wand and make everybody peaceful and live together happily, because we can do it in our private lives, so we should be able to do it in our national life as well. But it doesn't seem to, I don't know, it seems that the wrong people seem to get power. And
I think so many people listening to this will agree with what you're saying here. But in a way that it makes it so much even more important that we listen to people like you, Gabrielle, and we listen to your, what it is that you're saying and your experiences and your stories. And that's why it's such an honor to speak with you, because I understand you still go around and you speak to children and you go to schools and you tell your story. And you have quite a unique way of telling it, don't you, I believe? Because tell me how, when you go to address children, how do you tell your story?
And it does depend on the age of the children. I tend to sort of, you know, because I speak to high schools and primary schools, and you speak to them in different ways. I can't really explain it, but as an ex-teacher, I just adapt my story and tell it in such a way that I hope they will understand. And then when I speak to older pupils, I've even spoken to university students, and I try to sort of just change it a little bit, but it's the same story, but told in a slightly different way, you know.
But I remember you, in your book, you wrote that when you had gone to speak to a group of younger children, you told them a story of a little girl who came to England in the build-up to war. And then at the end of it, you said, "Can anyone guess who that girl was?" And one of the children said, "Is it you?"
Yes. Well, I tend to do that if I speak to very young children. I'll say to them, I've told you the story, but it was a true story. And who do you think that little girl might have been that I'm telling the story about? And they nearly always guessed that it was me.
And you tell it so beautifully. Your story is sometimes when you were recounting that, I got the sense that it was almost as if it happened to you yesterday.
And some of the things are so vivid in my mind that they could have happened yesterday. Other things are a little bit hazy. You know, for instance, when I came back from Berlin to Vienna, that, you know, I started school and everything was, my mother died 2 years later, you see, and came back for me to start school at six. And she died when I was eight. So that era of my life is not as clear as other parts of my life.
But those events almost feel like they're burned into your mind when you boarded that train with your teddy bear, and when you got on that boat and then you got the next train. I get the sense that when you're talking about it, it's so clear and vivid and in your mind. I guess it would be, because it's a staggering thing to happen in any child's life.
I suppose, yes. It is very vivid in my mind, yes. Yeah. I think my whole life, as I've told my story, I think memories flooded back. You know, sometimes, because my talk initially didn't last as long as it does now. Because I think as I've talked about things, certain incidents sort of flashed up in my mind, which I hadn't really thought about. I remember that now, but I hadn't really thought about it.
It's almost like little doors in your mind, isn't it? That once you start talking, you open other doors, and that leads to other memories that you think you've forgotten, but are all filed away, aren't they?
Yeah. I've got a letter from the last letter I received from the Catholic Committee for Refugees. I had asked for, I think it was a reference, a character reference, and this lady was still working there, and she gave me a good character reference. She said, "We are so proud of you, the committee, you know, we are so proud of you, what you've achieved," which she said somebody with less determination and courage wouldn't have achieved that. So I treasure that letter.
And you should, and you absolutely should.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.